I think your position is exactly correct, the president responded, looking across the table at the vice president. To Ford, the meeting and the president's speech seemed off-key. He thought Nixon was handling the moment badly.
If you have to run for office again, the president said to Ford, you're going to have to run your own campaign. I had very decent people, but it doesn't excuse their actions.
Turning to the budget, the president repeated that there would be no sacred cows on cuts in spending. That discussion went on for about a half hour. Then the president turned to a forthcoming summit meeting on the economy. Attorney General Saxby, directly across from the president, interrupted. Mr. President, I don't think we ought to have a summit conference. We ought to be sure you have the ability to govern. The president replied quietly and condescendingly, as if he were lecturing a schoolboy.
Bill, I have the ability, just as I have had for the last 5 years.
George Bush, sitting at the end of the table to the president's right, said he agreed with Saxby. The president's ability to govern was impaired. The president began to lecture him, but Kissinger intervened. He wanted to avoid any open disagreement.
It is a difficult period for the country. We must show that it is a going concern. It is essential that we show it is not safe for any country to take a run at us, so we can vindicate the structure for peace.
The president adjourned the meeting at 12:30 p.m. Large crowds were gathering outside the White House gates, and more than the usual number of reporters were waiting for the departing cabinet members. Simon was surrounded. The president sincerely believes he has not committed any impeachable offense, he said. He intends to stay. From outside the gates, voices shouted, "Tell us what happened! Tell us what happened!" Kissinger stayed behind when the meeting broke up and spoke briefly to the president. Then the secretary walked back to his office in the West Wing.
There was precious little support for the president, he told General Scowcroft.
Weak-livered was the way he characterized Attorney General Saxby. Saxby and George Bush had been petty and insensitive, Kissinger said. He compared the situation to a 17th-century royal court with the courtiers scurrying about, concerned with themselves rather than their country. The cabinet meeting had depressed him. There was always the possibility that some foreign power would do something foolish. Barry Goldwater had driven to his office early. After having spent a brooding evening, he was angry. He blamed himself, in part, for the current nightmare. He should have pushed Nixon harder to be open and frank. His concern had been the office and the party, not Nixon. But he had been overly protective nonetheless. It had taken him too long to apply his stern, no-nonsense judgment. Christ, Goldwater was thinking. He had never really had a conversation with Nixon. He had never gotten through to him. He would come in to discuss one thing, and damned if the president didn't act as if he hadn't heard it. Now Goldwater realized that he didn't even like the man. Nixon had an obsession with the outward signs of power, trumpets, dressing up the White House guards, ceremonies. To Goldwater, this was, in one of his favorite expressions, a bucket of shit. Goldwater thought Nixon was not a man's man, someone with whom he could drink or joke or have a frank heart-to-heart discussion. He was thinking of the contrast with John F. Kennedy. At a particularly tense moment during the Bay of Pigs invasion period, President Kennedy had said to him, "So you want this fucking job?" Goldwater now concluded that Nixon was off his head, and had been for quite a while, and that he had probably known about the Watergate break-in in advance. Shortly after Goldwater arrived at his office, Bush called to tell him that an emergency cabinet meeting was scheduled. The senator was snappish.
"I don't think the president can get 15 votes in the Senate," he told Bush. "I'm not going to protect him anymore."
Bush wasn't sure what to do next. Apparently, Nixon was ready to bring even further ruin on himself and the party. "How can we impress upon the president the seriousness of this?" he asked Goldwater. The senator didn't have any answers, but he promised to stay in touch. Before the cabinet meeting, Bush spread the word of Goldwater's gloomy assessment to others, including Dean Birch. Goldwater was at a Senate Space Committee hearing on the Hill when he received a message to call Haig or Birch. Interrupting a witness to whom he had addressed a question, he apologized and went out to return the call. He reached Birch. Between 13 and 17 Senate votes, Goldwater told him, refining his earlier estimate of 15. And that is all. I have talked to enough people on the floor to know that he has lost. He asked Birch to pass the information on to Haig. Birch informed Haig at the end of the cabinet meeting. This was what Haig had needed. He planned to use it to help tip the scales, and it would not have to come out of his own mouth. The vice president had canceled a morning speech to attend the cabinet meeting. At 1:15 p.m., he headed for the Senate GOP policy luncheon. Senator Tower immediately asked him to report on the cabinet meeting. Ford tried to brush it over, saying that he had told the cabinet he would make no more comments and that the president had agreed. The balance of the cabinet meeting dealt with the economy, Ford said. The usually placid lunch erupted. The senators wanted more detail on the earlier part of the cabinet meeting. The president said that he was not guilty of an impeachable offense, Ford replied. He conceded that the House battle was lost and that the Senate would make the final decision. The cabinet members did not speak much. George Bush did speak out and noted that the situation in the House was serious. What else did George say? Goldwater asked, wondering to himself if Bush was peddling a different line to the cabinet than he had peddled to Goldwater that morning. He just generally spoke of the deteriorating situation in the House, Ford answered. Well, that bothers us a great deal, Goldwater said. He exploded. The House Judiciary Republicans and John Rhodes realize that the situation is hopeless. Maybe the president is right in that the Senate will determine the final outcome, but he is only right legally and technically. We can't support this any longer. We can be lied to only so many times. The best thing that he can do for the country is to get the hell out of the White House and get out this afternoon. Goldwater's well-tanned face was red. We have all been waiting to hear from Barry on this, said Senator Jacob K. Javits of New York. He made a moving statement. Everybody would be better off if the president resigned today. Goldwater was called out of the room to take a call from Haig. When he picked up the line, the operator said that General Haig was calling from the Oval Office. Goldwater heard a click on the line and guessed that the president was listening on an extension. Barry, said Haig, what is your gut feeling about what the Senate will do? Haig knew from Birch that Goldwater was in a message-sending mood. Goldwater was now convinced that the president was listening. This was his chance to get his message across forcefully. Al, Goldwater said angrily, the president has only 12 votes in the Senate. He has lied to me for the last time and lied to my colleagues for the last time. Back inside at the Republican policy lunch, the vice president was trying to cool off the group. Henry Kissinger made a fervent plea to hold firm because of foreign policy problems, Ford said. Regardless of Watergate, the cabinet as a whole, he said, should be undivided on foreign policy. He was not making a casual comment on this. He said this would be a very adverse time to show a lack of support for U.S. foreign policy or its implementation. Ford seemed almost shy about discussing what had happened. It is a frightening experience that all of this concern by Republicans is not having any impact at all on the White House, Senator Brock said. 74-year-old conservative Senator Norris Cotton offered the first concrete proposal. He was sitting one seat from Ford, and he turned to him. I have suffered through this along with everybody else, he said. We are all in an impossible position. We are potential jurors, and our positions are hardening even though we have not heard the evidence. For the welfare of this nation, however, all of this talking to each other is foolish. We should talk to the president and convey to him the danger of his position if the Senate holds a trial. We should send a special Senate delegation to see him, an uncommitted delegation. I sympathize with Barry. We sit here very quietly, and the president is going along in his own way and at his own pace. We can't sit quietly any longer. When Norris Cotton started talking about not sitting quietly, things were serious.
"Gentlemen," said Ford, "in light of this discussion, I really must leave the room. I can't stay any longer. It wouldn't be proper for me to remain."
He left at 1:40 to a standing ovation. The senators continued their discussion. Wallace Bennett of Utah: "In my opinion, his resignation is more damaging than a conviction." Dominic of Colorado: "Does the president know how we feel? The list of potential charges against him is incredible. His case is insupportable. He ought to get out now and not be forced out by the Congress."
Tower of Texas:
"We have not yet gone to the White House with any of this because right now there is too much filtering of information. We can't get through."
Clifford P. Hansen of Wyoming:
"We must send a delegation to the White House. I suggest that Barry Goldwater, Jack Javits, and Bob Griffin transmit our personal thoughts to the president."
Brock of Tennessee:
"The White House is currently doing a damage evaluation. Let Tom Corologos or Bill Timmons know your feelings."
Roth of Delaware: "We ought to move today." Charles H. Percy of Illinois:
"I think we ought to ask ourselves, if the country is moving as fast as this city is, Peoria says slow down a bit. Don't jump the gun."
Milton R. Young of North Dakota:
"If the Senate holds a trial, then the Republican Party goes down with it."
Griffin of Michigan:
"I hope that what we are saying here today does not find its way into the Washington Post tomorrow morning. Bill Brock is right. The White House information is good, and headcounts have been taken. I spoke to Al Haig and to Tom Corologos."
Edward W. Brooke of Massachusetts:
"We must be realistic. The country and the party have been hurt. The two-party system is important. A Senate trial, which St. Clair says could take 6 months, would kill all important legislation now pending in Congress. This would be detrimental to the country. As for the president, what can he gain by going to trial in the Senate? If he chooses to go through the impeachment process, he will lose decisively. A delegation must be sent to see him and explain the options. If he doesn't resign now, serious harm will come to the country and the party."
William L. Scott of Virginia:
"We are all shocked by recent events, but will we feel this way next week? I support the delegation idea, but we really ought to think about this for a few days."
McClure of Idaho:
"I agree with Bob Griffin on the problem of leaks today. If you're going to talk to reporters, don't include me in any assessment of our mood. Don't curry favor with the press by revealing our comments to them. The White House must get an accurate account of this meeting. The leadership can go down there, but Barry Goldwater is the one blunt enough to do the job."
Charles M. Mathias, Jr. of Maryland: "Norris Cotton's suggestion is good in terms of what the White House should know. We must convey our feelings directly to the president. The question is how. It must be an impressive demonstration." Cotton of New Hampshire:
"If the country gets the idea that we are prejudging this thing, we are in trouble. We must keep an open mind."
Mathias: "I agree. The House has not yet voted." Peter V. Domenici of New Mexico:
"Our leadership should go to the White House."
Jerry Warren was confused. In spite of the president's firm declaration to the cabinet that he would not resign, Ziegler had taken Warren aside before the press briefing and instructed him to back off slightly. "Don't close the door as tightly as Simon," Ziegler advised.
"I think resignation is inevitable, Ron," Warren volunteered.
He was rarely this outspoken with his boss, who he was sure had enough problems dealing with the president. Ziegler just looked at Warren and allowed the observation to pass. Ziegler wasn't saying much for more than the usual reasons. Earlier, Ray Price's secretary had called Judy Johnson.
"It's ready," Margaret Foote said.
Johnson had no idea what was ready, but relayed the message to Ziegler. Ziegler himself had walked to Price's office in the EOB to pick up the folder. He brought it back to his office and locked it up. It contained Price's draft of a resignation speech. Ziegler didn't want Warren to know. For 18 months, Warren had been the administration's front man. He was always the last to know, deliberately kept in the dark so that he would not have to tell outright lies. The president, and Haig, and Ziegler as well, tried never to feed patently false information through Warren. His credibility, such as it was, had to be preserved. Warren had learned the role the hard way, and had accepted it. Now he had expressed his opinion. Ziegler's silence was a signal, perhaps, or maybe Ziegler was just too tired and worn out to argue. Ziegler recognized that the reason the president had insisted to the cabinet that he would stay was to keep his options open for a little while longer. To have even hinted that he might not hold firm would be tantamount to announcing his departure. It might even be a provocation. The desertions would steamroll. The last contingent of loyalists would then have their reason to abandon the cause. Also, there was the possibility that the president might still resist, or there might be a foreign crisis that would preclude resignation. Ziegler told Warren to say that the president intended to pursue the constitutional process. That would be construed as a less rigid position than Simon had described. During his 30-minute press briefing, Warren used the phrase constitutional process a dozen times. It was a rough session, even by prevailing standards, and Warren's mission was to cut around the edges, to shift position slightly. He could not contradict Simon. That would mean contradicting the president. Question. Can you say today that the president will not resign, Warren? The president's intention is to follow the constitutional process. Question. Jerry, you are dodging the question. Warren. I am not dodging the question. I am putting it in perspective. Question. Can you repeat for us today, Jerry? This is important. Yesterday, you said he will not resign. Can you say that today? Warren. The issue is not, if I may be so bold, whether or not the president will resign. The president intends, and he told the cabinet this today, the president intends to pursue the constitutional process. That means, ladies and gentlemen, he does not intend to resign. But by the time Warren's briefing was over, all 10 of the president's supporters on the House Judiciary Committee had announced that they would vote to impeach. So had Rhodes, though he had carefully refused to join the call for resignation. The House and the Senate were very tense. Members hung around the cloakrooms. They hung around the wire machines. They wrung their hands. They were unsure who was really running the White House. Al Haig was not a sufficient symbol of sovereignty. Most were looking for a way to accelerate the process of Richard Nixon's abdication. Griffin was worried. His call for resignation, a difficult thing for him to do, had fizzled. In his office that afternoon, he was notified that Ed Cox was on the phone. He had met Cox only casually. He picked up the phone and found a very disturbed young man on the other end of the line. Cox didn't know where to turn. He wanted to speak with someone in a leadership position in the Senate. The conversation was to be strictly confidential. As the president's son-in-law, Cox felt some responsibility for what was happening. As a member of the family, he had access to some disturbing information. It had to happen. The president had to resign. David Eisenhower agreed, Cox said, but they had not been able to persuade their wives. The president's daughters had closed their minds on the subject, and they had tremendous influence on their father. Cox couldn't even talk to his wife about it. On the Sequoia trip the night before, Cox said, the president had made it clear that he was not going to quit. Cox asked what was happening in the Senate. At least one of the members, Griffin told him, was going to go down and tell the president how desperate the situation had become. That was good, Cox said, but he repeated his belief that the president was going to hang on. Cox sounded distraught. He was worried about the president's mental health. The president was not sleeping, and he had been drinking. The man couldn't take it much longer, Cox said. The president had been acting irrationally. Griffin interrupted to say that he had been to meetings with the president recently, and Nixon had been rational. That was the problem, Cox replied.
The president went up and down. He came back from meetings and was not rational, though he had been fine at the meeting. The president... Cox began. His voice rose momentarily. The president was up walking the halls last night, talking to pictures of former presidents, giving speeches, and talking to the pictures on the wall. Griffin braced himself. Cox was worried about Mrs. Nixon, too. She was the only one near the president late at night, and her strength was gone, her depression too deep to cope with anything that might happen. Cox tried to explain. He hated to raise it, but he was worried about what the president might do to himself. The president might take his own life. Griffin asked about the Secret Service. They could help Mrs. Nixon. Yes, Cox said, that was a good idea. He would see about getting the Secret Service to stay in the family quarters. Then Cox and Griffin agreed that it was amazing that the president had been able to stand up at all under this pressure. Griffin wanted to calm Cox, who was rambling and sounding slightly unstable himself. I can't talk to my wife, Cox said. She is determined that her father shall not resign. Griffin was most concerned about Mrs. Nixon. Who were her close friends? Mamie Eisenhower? But she was not that close, Cox said. How about the Reverend Billy Graham? Cox agreed that that was a good idea, and Griffin promised to contact Graham to see if he would talk to the Nixons. Griffin called Graham in Chicago and left a message. He was shaken. Ed Cox, a young lawyer, was not given to hysterics. Griffin had rarely heard an adult so disturbed. The possibilities of catastrophe seemed endless. Macabre visions flashed. There was no way to let this slide by. Griffin walked over to Ford's office in the Senate and told his worries to the vice president. Ford was not upset or worried, though he expressed sympathy for the Nixon family. He seemed to have a plan all laid out. He had talked with Haig again today. Things were going smoothly. The president had not done a good job at the cabinet meeting that morning, Ford said. It was all very sad. Griffin wasn't sure exactly what Ford was talking about. President Nixon was expected to resign, Ford said, and he was going to become president. That was to be kept very quiet. Ford seemed matter-of-fact and somewhat removed. Griffin left rather perplexed. He had done all he could as a Republican leader. He had written an extraordinary letter saying he would vote to convict the president if all the tapes were not turned over, and then had gone so far as to call upon the president to resign. Those were bold steps for a normally cautious man. Now it seemed that the president was going in one direction, Haig and Ford in another, Ed Cox perhaps in still another. When Griffin finally talked to Graham, he told him that the Nixon family needed help. The president was terribly depressed, and it would be helpful if Dr. Graham could get to him and reach him spiritually. As an old friend, he was one of the few who could help. It was serious. Graham didn't want to seem to be forcing himself on Richard Nixon, certainly not at this moment. He called the White House and left word that he was available. Then he flew to New York so that he would be in the East. If he went to Washington, it might be interpreted as another signal. Once in New York, he called the White House again and left his phone number. He was nearby and could get a plane to Washington on a moment's notice. The president was not fully persuaded by Goldwater's assessment. Goldwater was excitable. The president was sure he still had friends in the Senate. The week before, Bill Timmons had passed word through Haig that the president had 35 votes and that there were another 8 to 10 that might go either way. Now the president called Timmons to his office alone. The president's hard core was down to 20 votes, Timmons said, and he saw no hope of getting the 34 votes for acquittal. But he was not an attorney, Timmons added cautiously, and if the attorneys felt that the case could be won on its legal merits, some of the lost ground might be recovered. Nixon was interested in specifics. He gave Timmons the names of 5 senators to call. Timmons reported back that all 5, Nixon loyalists, had said they would not vote to convict, but that they all said the situation was hopeless. At 4:30 p.m.,
8 members of the Senate GOP leadership met to decide who should carry a message to the White House. Senators Javits and Goldwater were present as representatives of the party's left and right. They joined Hugh Scott, Griffin, Block, Tower, Bennett, and Cotton. John Stennis was suggested, but Scott insisted that it was a Republican mess and that Republicans should handle it. Goldwater was finally chosen to go alone. At 5:19, Goldwater placed a call to Bill Timmons. He didn't get through. On his way back to his office, Goldwater stopped by to see Stennis and ask if he wanted to go with him to the White House the next day.
"I'd go," Stennis said, "but I'd prefer the constitutional process."
Goldwater was sure that Stennis could be persuaded, but he didn't try. Next, Goldwater reached Dean Birch by phone at the White House.
"I know what you want," Birch said.
He suggested that Goldwater come to lunch at his house the next day before he saw the president. Goldwater agreed. White House staff members were watching for signals. Price was being observed very closely to see if he was working. If the president was going to resign, he'd have to announce it. He'd need a speech. Price was the logical man to write it. There were reports that Vice President Ford was about to cancel his speaking trip to the West Coast that was to begin on Thursday. Rabbi Korf saw the president in the afternoon.
"Is there anything I can do for you?" the president asked again.
"I don't want you to resign."
"Foreign affairs might suffer irreparable harm," the president said. "If I am busy in the Senate with a trial, televised before the nation would be polarized."
For half an hour, Nixon reviewed his thinking. He didn't say what he was going to do, but Korf got the impression that the president was going to step down. Nixon vacillated, now lashing out at his enemies, proclaiming the massive injustice of it all, and then drifting back to the damage a Senate trial might do the country. Korf requested an autographed photograph and left. He had scheduled a press conference after the meeting, but he canceled it and went out a side exit. One reporter caught up with him. Korf was visibly discouraged, but he would continue to support the president. "Richard Nixon will go down in history as the greatest president of the century." Washington was rife with rumors. Some of the senators who had been at the GOP policy lunch told reporters that there was a wave of anti-Nixon sentiment and that Goldwater felt that the president should resign. One report had it that Goldwater had said the president would resign. This made it onto television. So did an equally incorrect report that Goldwater had tried to gain entrance to the White House that afternoon but was refused. Just before 7 p.m., Goldwater called Scott to complain that a member of the minority leader's staff had leaked the plan for Goldwater to go to the White House. Next, Goldwater called one of the TV reporters and gave him hell for the false story. The more Goldwater thought about it, the angrier he got. Finally, he stormed onto the Senate floor and asked for unanimous consent to speak for 30 seconds. It was granted, and Goldwater denied the reports. Then he looked up at the press gallery, which was rapidly filling, raised his fist, and said loudly, "You are a rotten bunch." There was applause from the visitors' gallery and from some members of the Senate. Birch had told Goldwater that the president was heading toward resignation, but he had emphasized that it was important that no one else publicly join Griffin. That evening, Goldwater discussed the situation with his wife. Wednesday, he would call for resignation, and that would be a political disaster in Arizona, where he was running for re-election. He wondered if he should withdraw from the race.
"No," his wife said.
Until mid-Tuesday, the president had acted almost smug about the reaction to the June 23rd transcripts. Once again, Haig worried about his own credibility with the president. He had to get the president to appreciate that the staff was telling him the truth. The sour news from the Hill removed that problem but raised another. Haig was concerned about a meeting between the president and Goldwater. It must not be initiated by Goldwater. Also, Goldwater was apt to fly off the handle. A confrontation would be disastrous and could serve only to buttress the president's resistance. The president couldn't resign because of congressional pressure
any more than because of pressure from his own staff. First, he had to be convinced that he had the option to stay. Haig sat in his office, considering the next move.
"The next few days will be full of tragedy," he told his staff,
and he repeated the remark he was becoming famous for among his associates.
"You just can't believe what these last weeks have been like."
Haig had been through enough Nixon decisions to sense that the president had just about decided to quit.
Nixon's statements on the matter had by no means been consistent, but they pointed that way. That was the best he could expect at that moment.
Nixon's support had crumbled, or had at least been neutralized. The news from the Hill, Goldwater, Rhodes, the judiciary loyalists, Nixon's favorite Southern Democrats, was all negative. Ford wasn't knocking on any doors to urge a fight. The cabinet had been muted. Haig was working for a resignation announcement on Thursday night. There was a problem. The president had said he would consider a Thursday night resignation announcement. Consider it. The decision was far from final. So Haig had to take some steps. He told Kissinger and Ford that Thursday would be the day. Haig had a call from Haldeman on that Tuesday. Haldeman wanted a pardon. Haig was noncommittal, unencouraging, and worried. This was something he didn't need, especially now. He called Jaworski in Houston.
"Leon, you better come back. I think you ought to be here."
Jaworski promised to return at once. That night, Philip Buchan took a cab to Gerald Ford's home in Alexandria for dinner. Mrs. Ford had called Buchan the week before and reminded him that he hadn't been out to the house for some time. At first, dinner was set for Friday, August 2nd, but then it was moved to Tuesday so that Buchan could return to Michigan for a dental appointment and his annual physical. The taxi arrived at Ford's house about 7 o'clock. Betty Ford greeted Buchan at the door, and the two went into the den to watch the evening news and await Ford. Buchan had a martini on the rocks.
"The GOP gave up today on Richard Nixon," led the CBS News.
There was an obituary tone to all references to the president. NBC correspondent Ronald Nesson was shown asking Ford if President Nixon was keeping him informed. Ford's smiling response,
"No comment. See you later.
Nice try, Ron." The vice president arrived and dashed upstairs to change into his swimming trunks. As a mess steward completed preparations for dinner, Ford swam some laps in the backyard pool. The dinner conversation conveyed no sense of urgency. They talked about Steve Ford's plans. The vice president's 18-year-old son had a summer job mowing grass on the George Washington Memorial Parkway. He had been accepted at Duke University for the fall term, but he was considering taking a year off. After supper, Ford, Mrs. Ford, and Buchan sat in the living room. Ford looked almost serene. Buchan couldn't stand it any longer. "Look," he said, "you better tell me what's going on."
"It will all be over in 72 hours, Ford replied calmly.
He had received word from Haig earlier in the day.
"Damn it,"
Buchan thought, wondering if he ought to dash out that moment and get down to serious organizing. Ford's demeanor only made Buchan more agitated. He was distressed at Ford's slowness. He understood that his friend had been unwilling to make any move that might look as if he were elbowing his way into the presidency, but now there was no longer time for appearances. Buchan's friend of 35 years was about to take over the government. Buchan told Ford what he and Whitted had been doing. Pitifully inadequate work with the transition 72 hours away. "Now look," Buchan said, "tell me who I can call on immediately." The transition team would have to be expanded. Buchan, Whitted, Jonathan Moore, Brian Lamb, and Larry Lynn were not equipped for this. Maybe no one was. People with more stature and experience would have to be included. Ford suggested Senator Griffin, former Congressman John W. Burns of Wisconsin, Secretary of the Interior Morton, U.S. Steel Vice President William G. White, and Bryce Harlow, who had left the White House several months earlier. Buchan wanted someone from outside Washington and suggested former Pennsylvania Governor William W. Scranton. Ford agreed.
Buchan said he would contact them that night. Betty Ford got her address book and gave Buchan the phone numbers of the men who would be added to the transition team. "We'll get them together as quickly as possible," Buchan said. Ford explained that it was essential that no information get out. Buchan, more than Ford, seemed struck by all that had to be accomplished. The swearing-in, immediate appointments, briefings, and inaugural speech, and all those matters that a new president normally had months to consider. Buchan was eager to leave and get to a phone. As they went to the door, he kissed Betty Ford and put his arm around the next president. He mumbled a few words of encouragement. Everyone would rise to the occasion, he felt. He had been through a lot with his friend. "It's happening," he said. Events were about to thrust into the presidency a man who had stood for election only in Ionia and Kent counties in one of Michigan's 19 congressional districts. "I'm proud of you," Buchan said. The cab arrived to take him downtown to the university club where he was staying. On the way, Buchan reflected on his long friendship with Ford. In the summer of 1940, Buchan had clerked for a New York City law firm and almost joined it. But instead, he had gone into partnership with Ford. The New York law firm was the one Richard Nixon joined in the early 1960s. Buchan wondered if he had stayed in New York, might he have been one of the new law partners Nixon brought to Washington? What would he have done during Watergate? The first call Buchan made when he got back to his club was to his wife. Next, he called Whitted. "I've just talked to Jerry," Buchan said, with deep concern in his voice. "And he said that Haig has told him you'll be president in 72 hours. They agreed to gather the old and new transition teams. Buchan was less precise to Bill White. "The vice president wants a group of his close advisors to meet," he said. White offered his house. Buchan then had to introduce himself to Bryce Harlow over the phone. Announcing that he spoke on the vice president's behalf, Buchan asked Harlow to attend an important meeting the next night. Harlow wondered who the hell Buchan was and why it was so important to meet him, but he put his reservations aside when he heard that the gathering was at Bill White's. Harlow knew that White wouldn't be involved in any skullduggery. In the East Wing, where the staff members most involved in the first family's personal life worked, Susan Dolebois, a former aide to Charles Colson and a hardcore loyalist, said the new transcript was a slap in the face. Chief Usher Rex Skouten, who had been on the Nixon Secret Service detail during the vice presidential days, was forgiving. His main concern was the family. Terry Ivey, assistant press aide to Mrs. Nixon, was torn and unhappy, shattered by the fact that the president had let his daughter Julie go around the country defending him and had not told her the truth. The president had told his daughter not to do it, Ivy knew, but he had never explained why she should not. Ivy, like many others, was beginning to realize that she might not have a job much longer. Haig got a few hours' sleep that night. He was more determined than ever to deal toughly with Congress. Republican leaders must not be allowed to descend on the White House and try to force a resignation. To Haig, that was more menacing than a military coup. It would alter the American political system forever. Haig was sinking into bitterness, or as much bitterness as he would ever allow himself. Nixon was a product of the political system, not an aberration, and he didn't see things getting better with Ford. He believed that someone like himself could never make it in politics.
Wednesday, August 7th.
On this morning, Alexander Haig felt the burden of government acutely. His job was to prevent a rout. Haig wanted to smooth the way for the country, for the president, and for himself. He could see, hear, and feel the erosion. Everything was crumbling at once. This was the last dismal stage of the battle, a defeat of dimensions such as he had never experienced. He had read about defeat. This was what it was. Noise, irrationality, collapse on all sides. The completeness seemed so unexpected. Then, in calmer moments, it seemed clear and inevitable. The Hill, the press, traditional Nixon supporters, members of the White House staff, even old friends. Haig was sure he could deal with them. He was not sure he could deal with Nixon. He was afraid the president might kill himself. Over the past months, there had been certain references to death and suicide. At first, they were oblique and often expressed in Nixon's impatient manner. The president was thinking out loud, probably. This week, Nixon had finally approached the subject head-on. The two men had been alone.
"You fellows, in your business," the president began, meaning the army, which he always seemed to consider Haig's real business. "You have a way of handling problems like this. Somebody leaves a pistol in the drawer." Haig waited. "I don't have a pistol," the president said, sadly, as if it were one more deprivation in a long history of underprivilege, as if he were half asking to be given one. It was the same tone he used when he talked about his parents not having had any money.
Afterward, Haig called the president's doctors. He ordered that all pills be denied the president, and that the sleeping pills and tranquilizers he already had be taken away. Haig also discussed the matter with Buzzard. At first, Haig was vague. He mentioned pills. It was not necessarily a question of suicide. Pills might interfere with decisions the president had to make and follow through on. Pills must not be available to act as a shield against reality. Then Haig told Buzzard he was taking every possible precaution to make sure that Watergate did not end in a presidential suicide. The president might see it as the only way to spare himself and the country the pain of moral recrimination. So Haig had taken steps to make sure the president did not have the means to kill himself. "The president wasn't the type," Buzzard responded. "Nixon had weathered adversities. The tougher things got, the tougher he seemed to get. And Buzzard was convinced that Nixon was a very religious man deep down. Religious men don't kill themselves." Haig said the president was a battered man, strained to his limit. He compared Nixon's behavior to that of Captain Queeg, the erratic naval officer in the Kane Mutiny. Queeg had been relieved of duty by his second-in-command because he was unable to function as his ship swirled out of control in a typhoon. Buzzard thought the analogy argued against a suicide. Queeg was a fighter. He had fought to the end. Haig and Buzzard talked about their experiences with Nixon. Haig was concerned that he really didn't know the president and had never felt close to him. Nixon was so private. Haig wondered sometimes what Nixon did when he was alone, because he spent so many hours that way. Buzzard said he felt the same overwhelming distance, but he thought he had been given a glimpse of the man that no other person had. Haig knew what Buzzard was referring to. After the secret taping system had been revealed, and they had to contend with the two missing tapes and the missing dictabelt of April 15th, Nixon had delivered some other dictabelts to Buzzard, recordings of his daily reflections. Perhaps they would allay his lawyer's suspicions, Nixon implied. When he'd heard them, Buzzard recognized that they were clearly not meant for anyone else's ears. Nixon hadn't even let Rose Woods transcribe them. Some of them were under subpoena, but Buzzard had argued to Judge Sirica that they were too personal to be released. Sirica had listened to one, had agreed, and had told the special prosecutor that they were not relevant to any investigation. From those recordings, sometimes they were small cassettes, Buzzard believed he had heard Nixon with his defenses peeled away. It was rare for a man in such a public position to keep so truthful a diary, Buzzard told Haig. Normally the diaries of public men served to provide a cover story for history. The Nixon dictations were a stark contrast. Buzzard said that his own most emotional moments in all of Watergate had come as he listened to the president reveal his emotions. The tapes provided a dark, almost Dostoevskian journey into Nixon's fears, obsessions, hostilities, passions, and inadequacies. Buzzard, who had spent years consulting doctors about his mother's mental illness, felt that the dictating sessions were genuine therapy for Nixon. The lawyer would not reveal any details, even to Haig. He would say only that Nixon had talked out of his real feelings, and oddly, he would discourse on everyday occurrences, the weather, the flowers in the White House garden, birds. One thing was clear, Buzzard said. The president thought he had to submerge his true feelings at any cost. At a young age, he had decided that he would have to keep his real emotions suppressed and expose only calculated emotions. He was convinced that was what others wanted. Sadly enough, Nixon's instincts were often finer than his calculations. The president had a secret life of sorts, material for a psychological novel, Buzzard said. He had compassion. He had talked about John Dean. Dean should not be judged harshly, because he was a young man who was in over his head, Nixon had said. The president was an introvert by nature. He had talked into his machine about his reactions to meeting people and campaigning. He hated it all, but he did it anyway, and thrust forward an outer shell no one could get through. Close relationships were impossible. His relationship with his wife was totally formalized. Even with his daughter Julie, he had rarely revealed his emotions. He played the strong, consoling father when what he really wanted was to reach out and be consoled. But Buzzard was certain that the exterior was still solid, and that it would hold. Haig was not inclined to linger over such analyses. He turned impatiently to the operational problems before him. He had to continue laying the foundation for resignation as quietly as possible. Most immediately, there was Goldwater's request to see the president with a message from the Republican leadership. The message was resignation. He had to head that off at all costs, and he had to do it himself. He had to see Goldwater personally, but not at the White House. There was too much rumor already. The Hill was also impossible. Haig talked to Birch, who told him Goldwater had already accepted an invitation to lunch at his home. It was decided that Haig should join them. Goldwater spent the morning in his large apartment on Cathedral Avenue, surrounded with his ham radio equipment and model cars. Birch called to set the time, 12:30, and tell him that Haig would be there. "Are you going to wear a suit?" Birch asked. Goldwater generally showed up at his house in Levi's and cowboy boots. "Shit, what do you expect me to wear?" Goldwater responded. It was a serious occasion. Then Birch told him that the president would see him that afternoon about 4 o'clock. Meanwhile, Haig went to see the president and discussed the upcoming meeting in terms of giving Goldwater an opportunity to tell the president about his chances in the Senate. The president said he wanted a broader picture and decided that Rhodes and Scott should come along as well. Haig left. It was too late to meet personally with Scott and Rhodes. He asked Timmons to invite them to the 4 o'clock meeting and to brief them. Timmons, too, thought congressional pressure might push Nixon backward. If the leaders were simply to tell the president that the situation was hopeless, they could all live comfortably with themselves. No one, Timmons believed, including himself, should take the responsibility for any more. Nixon would do what he wanted to, in spite of everyone. That was what he had always done. At 1:15, Timmons arrived at Scott's office. The senator was eating lunch. Timmons told him the president had asked personally to see the two minority leaders, as well as Goldwater. Scott was flattered. He thought it appropriate. "The president has been up and down on resignation," Timmons explained. "The family wants him to stay on. We just don't know exactly what will happen. It looks like he'll resign. But while I'm talking, he could change his mind." He said bluntly that a demand for resignation would increase the president's resistance, and Scott promised to tread lightly. Timmons was less frank with Rhodes. "The president wants to talk to you and to Hugh Scott and Barry Goldwater," he began. "Well, what about?" Rhodes asked. "He's thinking about making a decision and wants to know exactly what his situation on the floor of the House and the Senate is
before he makes it.
Well, Bill, does this decision encompass the possibility of resignation? Rhodes asked.
Yes, it does, Timmons said.
He told Rhodes the meeting was set for 4 o'clock at the White House.
Haig wanted to underscore the strategy to Scott. He put his grievances aside for the moment and called him.
Hugh, he said. He has almost been persuaded several times. The problem now is the family. If you demand his resignation, he'll probably harden up again. Would you just tell him the situation? He knows it, but he needs to hear it from you. He needs to know there are no alternatives, nothing else.
Scott agreed. Bob Haldeman stepped briskly along the pavement a few blocks from the White House. He went into the Bowen Building at 815 15th Street Northwest and took the elevator to the 6th floor. He was worried and wanted to review the situation with one of his attorneys, Frank Strickler. Haldeman had reached the president by phone the day before, but the question of pardons, though implicit, had not been directly discussed. Strickler came to the point. If Haldeman wanted a pardon, he had better get a specific request of the president quickly. A direct personal appeal might be the only way. For 10 days, both Haldeman and Strickler had known that a new crisis was building. Haig had called Haldeman soon after the Supreme Court decision to ask him what he recalled of the 3 conversations he had had with the president on June 23, 1972. Haig had been very concerned and had asked a lot of hard questions. What was the context of the conversation? What went on before and after each discussion? Haldeman wouldn't help. He couldn't remember much, had blocked most of it out of his mind, and on Strickler's advice, didn't bother to recall any more. When Haldeman hung up, he was sure that Haig had been saying that the president might not be able to remain in office once the tapes were disclosed. Now, Haldeman told Strickler, he was sure the end was imminent. Haig and the lawyers were panicking. The importance of those transcripts was being vastly overplayed. The president had revealed worse and had withstood it. Nixon was the victim of a putsch in his own White House, Haldeman thought. Strickler suggested that Haldeman get his justification for a pardon down on paper. Haldeman agreed. He needed to collect his own thoughts, and he knew that the president preferred to deal with formal proposals. On a personal basis, he began writing, better to close the chapter now than to have to sit by helplessly for the next several years and watch trials and appeals. Historically, would be far better to grant the pardon and close the door to such process than to let it run and have the trials become a surrogate impeachment. Also, history will look kindly on loyalty and compassion to subordinates caught in the web. Solves problem of potential prosecutor access to files and tapes by eliminating basis for further prosecution.
Also solves the problem of defense forcing access to the files.
The only way to wipe the slate clean is to shut down the prosecution totally. As long as it is there, there is a possibility of other new things. To avoid trauma of country, injustice to defendants, personal problems to RN, adverse historical effects, all point to necessity of overall pardon. Haldeman tried to get through by phone to Nixon, failed, and finally reached Haig. He quickly stated his request and outlined his reasons. Haig was appalled. He knew a threat when he heard one. Haldeman was talking about loyalty, about avoiding a trauma, personal problems for the president, and adverse historical effects. To Haig, it sounded as if Haldeman was warning that he would send Nixon to jail if he didn't get a pardon. Haig suppressed his anger and was again merely unencouraging. He didn't want to think about it, and he didn't want the president to have to think about it. The timetable for resignation was at least tentatively set, and this sort of thing could upset it. Nonetheless, Haig promised Haldeman that the request would get full consideration. The general was sensitive about Watergate conspirators asking for executive clemency. A crucial element in the first Watergate cover-up had been Howard Hunt's demands for clemency in exchange for silence. Now someone was trying to blackmail the White House again. Nightmare visions of
New cover-ups and obstructions of justice presented themselves, and he saw himself getting tangled up in them this time. But before he could ask for advice from the lawyers, Haig had to leave for Birch's house to meet Goldwater. The senator was already there when he arrived. Goldwater was shocked at Haig's appearance. The general's face was drawn and pale. He looked older, thinner, beaten physically and mentally.
"You look like death warmed over," Goldwater told him. "You should get out into the country."
He offered his place as a retreat. Haig said he'd been up for 4 straight days and nights. Goldwater figured that there was only one person who could keep Haig up 4 nights. That meant that the president had been sleepless, no condition in which to make decisions. He asked how the president was holding up physically and mentally.
"Fine," Haig said.
Birch nodded.
"Bullshit," Goldwater thought.
But he decided to stick to business. The 3 men sat down to a lunch of fruit and mixed seafood. Goldwater reported what many of the Senate Republicans had said at the GOP policy lunch the day before.
"No chance in the Senate," he summarized, adding that he himself was prepared to vote to convict on Article 2, the abuse of power charge.
"You know he'll tell you to shove it up your ass," Birch said of any attempt Goldwater might make to explain his position to the president.
"We don't need any more pushing him," Haig said. "We've had enough of that."
He went through his standard drill.
Some of the family were major obstacles.
They had been fiercely opposed to resignation. It was going to be dreadful when the family realized he had lied to them, Goldwater said. That would be hard on them and on him. Haig suggested that some members of the family were no longer resisting resignation. The 2 sons-in-law seemed to understand what had happened and what was happening now. The president was weighing his options, whether to stand trial and face certain defeat in the Senate or to resign in the best interests of himself and the country. He was 90% certain that the president would resign, Haig said, but a sudden, rapid spasm of the old Nixon will could change that, and the president would not permit Congress or the Republican leaders to dictate his decision. To even appear to be trying to force his hand could prove fatal, Haig explained. The problem was to keep Nixon on track. Goldwater saw the link between Griffin's inflammatory call for resignation on Monday and this lunch. Haig was quelling the fires. The general laid out the scenario. Goldwater would not be going alone. Scott and Rhodes would join him. The idea was to show the president how hopeless the situation was. Nothing more, nothing less. Don't even mention the word resignation, Haig insisted. Goldwater agreed. There was an additional problem.
Haldeman wanted pardons for everyone, Haig explained.
There was a lot of pressure on the president to issue pardons before resigning, pressure in the form of old loyalties. A simple signature on a piece of paper for old friends who had served so well. What would Goldwater advise?
"I don't think that would be wise," Goldwater said. "But he has the power, and if that is the cost, so be it."
Goldwater was willing to pay almost anything to get Richard Nixon out of office. It was about 2 p.m. when Haig arrived back at the White House. He went straight to the EOB office and briefed the president about Haldeman's request and his reasons and Goldwater's reaction to it. Nixon wanted more time to think about it and asked Haig to consult the lawyers. As Haig left, he ran into Garment.
"Len, walk along with me," he said.
Garment fell into step.
"I'm going to see Fred or Jim," Haig said, and asked if Garment knew where they were.
Buzzart was at the dentist, and St. Clair was in his favorite courtroom explaining that 9 of the 64 subpoena tapes didn't exist or couldn't be found, Garment said. Haig motioned Garment into St. Clair's empty office. The 2 men sat down. Garment thought Haig looked emaciated.
The general was clutching his lighter and cigarettes nervously in one hand.
"Things had to be brought to a conclusion," Haig said.
"The president was probably going to resign, and it was best that he go on his own steam."
One final snag had developed. Haldeman was urging the president to grant pardons for everyone involved in Watergate. The pressure was tremendous, Haig said. He had briefed the president. He had promised him he would check it out with the lawyers. What was the legal judgment? Could the president do it?
Totally out of the question, Garment said. It would be grotesque. Up to this point, he has, oddly enough, worked within the system, even though it is undoing him. Pardons would be outside the system. It would be saying to hell with the system, with justice. It would bring the roof down. Garment felt the heat increase in his body, his face. It would be the single most devastating thing that could be contemplated, he said. Goldwater found pardons tolerable, Haig said, if that was the price of resignation. The president wanted to know why, if Goldwater could stomach it, some of the staff couldn't. Is it conceivable? Haig asked again. Can it be done? Sure, Garment said. A president has the legal authority to grant pardons. But what would Watergate pardons include? Where did Watergate begin and other crimes stop? What do you do? Empty the prisons? Why can't it be done? Haig insisted.